Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're here to do what I think is our final Game of Thrones podcast, series wrap-up. We have, seen all of Game of Thrones, including the Last Watch documentary, which is a two-hour sort of behind-the-scenes kind of making of the final season documentary that HBO put out. And you can find that on HBO right now. We're also going to do a little bit of audience feedback and talk about a couple of other predictions and stuff that we had made before the season started. And I think it's always fun to go back and look at how completely wrong, or maybe in some cases right, we were. That's enjoyable. So, Aaron, what else are we going to do? Anything?
Yeah, I mean, I got some other thoughts. Because I've been listening to some other criticism and still haunting the forums and the Reddits and the places, the podcasts where this stuff gets talked. And there was one point in particular I want to talk about. But I thought maybe we could talk about the new thing that came out, which is the Last Watch documentary, which focused entirely on season 8. I guess let's open up the discussion. I guess I was pleasantly surprised at how little the Double D's played a part. And I wonder, was that intentional steering based on, or was that just like the Double D's? I'm trying to think, because like that's the other thing. I took a lot of baggage in this documentary, and I think I have some accurate conclusions, but I also think that there's a lot of the things I'm going to say that are fed into, that are produced because of my reaction to the season, okay? First thought is, Is it because the Double D's are in this for maybe 30 seconds. There's one of them that gives a speech on the last day of filming. There's a few that breeze by, and where they both breeze by and look at like some crypt whites from the Battle of Winterfell. Why were they not? Like, it'd be like watching the special features of Lord of the Rings and, Peter Jackson's not in it, which is not the case at all. What do you think, before I start speculating wildly, what do you think the reason is?
I mean, it seemed to me that the documentary was framed around like the people who were on set and actually put in the work to make this production part of the production happen, not like pre-production, not post-production at all.
Right.
It was all about the people on the scene at the time of filming, whether it comes down to directors or extras or hair and makeup, like people like that. So I think there wasn't room for them in this documentary, and it was already 2 hours, and, I almost feel like we needed another one or two parts to this to get the whole operation included.
You know, I didn't even realize about the fact that they also did not talk about the post-production at all. And that's maybe another reason why it felt a little bit hollow to me, because I was expecting something like The Lord of the Rings, where it's like, or DVD special features where it's like, here's the writing process and here's where we struggled and here's the thing. And we knew, like, I was hoping for like 10 or 15 minutes just to back and forth to Dave and Dan, like to kind of walk through. Didn't get any of that. Didn't get anything about the music, which is one of the best parts about the show. Didn't get anything about the special effects because the other thing is, like, when I was watching like the Battle of Winterfell footage being filmed, I'm like, I can see everything. Was somebody in the like post viz effects being like, more smoke, we need more smoke, we need more fog, less light, like, because it did seem like it was filmed in a way that like the shitty documentary cameras could see what was going on. So I don't know. Because my thought is maybe the Double D's, like HBO's like, hey, let's film a documentary. We've got all this footage of the stuff that we did before. And like Dan and Dave are literally just like, fiery tracks heading off towards wherever their home is in California or
license
Spain.
License plates that say Star Wars.
Exactly. So I don't know. Maybe because that would also explain the if the Double D's are like, yeah, well, do whatever you want, but whatever deuces, then maybe you just focus on what you got and the thing that
could be,
to blow the line, folks. Okay, what did you think? What was the tone and the mood and the emotion of the doc expressing? Which I thought was kind of curious myself. I want to see what you thought before I start coloring.
I think it is several things. One is just, the sadness that it's over, but also the relief that it's over. The sacrifice that people had to make this all happen. I think those were the three primary things.
Yeah. I was trying to, because again, I compare this to The Lord of the Rings, which is kind of the maybe my first experience with a like in-depth making of kind of Blu-ray style, just like look at this 27 hours of this thing. Mm-hmm. And how, like, there was a similar amount of pride. Like, the pride and skill and the craftsmanship that went into this season, undeniable. But yes, yeah, there was also this kind of like dread, both that it's kind of like, you know, there's a sadness of it's being over, but also like everyone universally is like, I get my life back. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, like, I think about how upbeat and passionate and toned the Lord of the Rings documentaries were. And those were all filmed in like a space of a year. And then they did a whole bunch of post work. And there was like a year or two, or like I think maybe 2 or 3 years of pre-work. But like that was like 3 or 4 years of a person's life. And they're super proud of it's out the door versus this stretched out over a decade. And some of the sacrifices these people made was intense.
Yeah, like, they kind of zoom in on the makeup and props department.
Yeah,
I think and the people, the husband wife team that sort of got in over their heads with this whole thing and didn't, you know, realize exactly what they were signing up for,
right,
when it became so huge, but got it done nevertheless. Yeah. And yeah, the sacrifice they had to make, they both had to be working on this full time in mm-hmm. different countries, and so their daughter had to stay home, very young daughter had to stay home without them,
yeah,
in the care of someone else the entire time.
She was like in between 3 and 5, and that's, you know, that's a tender age to be gone for like 3 months, like gone.
And then weeks and weeks of night shoots, just freezing cold up in Iceland, just frozen tundra as far as the eye can see.
Right.
You're up there for 14, 15 weeks. Just shooting every single night.
It does seem like there was some frustration about the season that they shot into. There's a lot of, it seemed like the artificial snow guy was pissed because, like, why do we shoot in the winter when there's not enough snow to dress it, but then there is any snow, then it's disastrous because it ruins the artificial snow. And
right.
Because I remember one of the reasons that people said it had to be filmed in this particular time slot is because obviously winter's coming and you want a bunch of snow in the ground. And that didn't really seem to be, like, maybe that one scene where they go to Sweden or Norway and they filmed in fjords with the waterfalls and then added a bunch of ditches, like maybe that is where the snow was, but holy shit, so much of that was green screen anyway.
Yeah,
like that was, I think, was amazing, as they went to this amazing location and then the two actors were standing in front of mini green screens because, of course, you got to throw in another waterfall. I don't know. I guess I was surprised at how kind of, and maybe again, this is my emotional state. I was surprised at how kind of dour all the proceedings were and how like stressed and pissed everybody was.
My favorite person, I think, in that whole documentary is the snow guy.
Yeah.
Because he, you could tell he's working his ass off.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when shit happens, like, oh, real snow fell, we can't do our job as the snow people. But the one thing I took away from that is I think we finally settled whether it was snow or ash.
King's
in
snow.
In King's Landing. It's both.
Yeah.
It would be both, right?
Yeah.
Because obviously the ash would fall. But he was putting down snow and saying things like, oh, as if it had drifted inside the walkways here.
So
like,
we see a one flake on Jamie's hand, so this is the excuse I got, the blast snow and King's Island. So yeah, there
it's
was
both definitive. Yeah. Which I thought was nice. But yeah, he seems like he is so far, like, over his head is not the right term because that implies that he can't handle it.
Uh-huh.
But he's in so fucking deep on this thing,
right?
That I just look at the fields that he's trying to dress with snow and the methods that they have for doing that, which, yeah, they have a machine, but also I see people pouring out, like going over it with the machine and then going in and fine tuning with big bags of it. And then
you gotta take the tire tracks out. And
right. It looked like that alone was enough to employ like 10 people for months and months.
And then the other thing that's crazy is like they were packaging up the snow to drag it to another set because it's cheaper to do that than buy more snow,
I guess.
When it's just paper and water is what the... Mm-hmm. Yeah, like some of the, and his theme of like, I don't want to waste any money. And then they made it a point like 15 minutes later in a documentary, just have him specify just one blue towel, please. Don't want to waste any. Like that seemed to be, you know, the reason he's managing the mountains of snow is because he's going to make sure if you got $3,000 budgeted for snow, you're going to spend $3,005.
Yeah, no, that's the thing.
You're going to spend $2,997.37 and by God, he'll have the three pennies. left over and change.
That was the thing that really impressed me is they just mention it sort of as an offhand comment. It's the idea that they are doing film finish on a TV budget and timescale.
Yes.
And that's the thing that I don't think, like when you see it on screen, you don't factor that in, right? Mm-hmm. That the timescales and most importantly, the budget is just not what a big movie is. And yet we're getting effects.
Oh, yeah.
And set dressings and makeup and acting and directing, all these things that we expect of films, they're delivering on those much smaller budgets and times.
Yeah, and I guess I mean, intellectually you're aware of like how much wiggery goes on, but like essentially every woman's head that's dressed in the show, it's a wig.
Yeah.
And like what you have to do to like get ready to make a wig so it doesn't look like a wig and how much
and
that
then in
like,
between shots, you're in there with like your fingers.
It feels like Amelia's in the chair as long as the Night King. So I mean I know that's literally not true, but she had one of the earliest hair and makeup calls just because getting that regal fucking badass signature Danny pile of hair and improbable braids configuration takes a long time. What did you think of the Stark Bannerman?
The Andrew McClay guy, is that his name?
Yeah, it seems like he maybe like the Bannerman extras, like the hero extras, seem like they're the ones that have the most fun on these things.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because they're just
because they come back year after year and hang out with friends, right?
And just seeing them geek out at like, oh, you know, when they're walking into like their the first day of their call, and they're like, oh my god, look, there's all these Stark Kings. They're going to be in the, how cool that is, and being on these massive sets and wearing the arms and armor, it just seems like it is a ton of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem like, you know, we got to hang out with one of the hero zombies of like The Walking Dead, and it does feel like that those are, because you're hanging out with the big celebrities and they're usually talking to you, and there is kind of a like the his it's so weird because they built up his emotional arc was essentially to give Kit Harington one of his extra jackets.
Uh-huh.
And okay, fair enough.
Yeah. My kid tried to give him money for it, which is funny.
Right. That's the Danny Burns King's Landing plot of the season 8 documentary. Just I'm not sure if this all follows as an emotional core, if it works, how I'm feeling, if it subverted my expectations. I don't know. I just feel like that this documentary, I wasn't expecting it to change my mind. I don't think it would. And I felt like it blew my mind at how smart it was, because if you got into any of the editing or if you got in any of the story writing, it's just going to be a fucking minefield. But if you just concentrate on the stuff that everybody, even the quote unquote haters, go out of their way to be like, hey, this shit might not make sense from like narrative standpoints, but it looks amazing. It's mm-hmm. well acted. And this is just why, like, just a sheer amount of stuff. It's actually kind of amazing that they were able to do all this for the budget they did have.
Oh, like, yeah.
The King's Landing set alone is insane.
It is. I was sort of watching it with the mentality of or with in a minute that Star Wars making of episode 3 documentary.
Yeah, kind of watching it
with that in mind, and that is definitely a more holistic look at filmmaking process.
Right.
This is much more a focus on the people who were on set mm-hmm. during those final filming scenes.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is like everybody's at all different levels of cinematic appreciation. Like this could be very mm-hmm. you know, for a lot of people who Game of Thrones is like their first show they've ever covered or first series they're into, like a lot of this stuff is going to be a real revelation, like just how much work and all the behind the scenes stuff. But it left a person like me who's gone through a lot of this with the different Marvel movies and Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and even, you know, more serious film type criticism, like this was kind of unsatisfying because it was just a very small part of it. But that's the thing that I keep starting to talk about is, when did they decide to do this documentary? Because it felt to me that it steered around the stuff that everybody thought was going to be surefire bang, and I wonder if HBO knew how long they suspected that this might be. Well, let's talk about the table read, because I think this goes into it.
Yeah.
You saw the reaction to Arya stabbing the Night King. Of course, that's a moment of triumph. But then you saw like people's reactions to like Conleth Hill's reaction to Varys getting burned, and like and Kit Harington, who went into that room, you know, the story goes, not reading the script, and him I mean, it's so easy. That's like a Rorschach test. Like, is Kit Harington disgusted? Is he disappointed? Is he moved? Is it like what? Like, I feel like the fans are putting a lot of their own analysis on different character reactions when they see reviews and they see press appearances. And this, we kind of went through this Mark Hamill in The Last Jedi. What's your read on how the table read went? How everybody's kind of. Like what was the behind? What do you think the behind the scene reaction to this thing is before we all got to see it?
My feeling is that everyone there was genuinely devastated by what they were reading. I felt like, you know, Kit and Amelia's and Conlith's reactions were genuine. Like they were genuinely shocked and saddened by what they were reading and what was happening to them as characters. I think Conlith Hill was maybe the most affected, though he didn't show it quite as much as the others. He seemed almost angry.
Yes.
He seemed almost pissed off that Varys... I don't know why exactly, but that Varys was dead.
Went out like this.
Yeah, maybe it's like this, or maybe it's just that it happened, because I know a lot of actors get pissed off when they, you know, make it this close to the end of the series and then get killed off. Mm-hmm. He's one episode from, you know, finishing this thing out.
Right.
Maybe he thought he was going to live, and then it turned out he didn't. I don't know, but yeah, I got the impression that all of these reactions... were genuine, that Conlith may have been, you know, devastated but also angry a little bit, and Kit and Amelia were just shocked and sad.
I wish I could have seen the reaction to Dany burning the city. I wish I could see the reaction to Jaime leaving Brienne and dying with Cersei. I wish I could have said it would have been my perfect making of, which I'm, you know, maybe this will be in a season 8, is like I would love to see every single character's or actor's face as they got to like their final scene. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what did Gwendolyn Christie think about her finishing off the white book with Jaime? So there's just a lot of stuff there that I don't know. I felt like they were kind of editing around what has been talked about of like some strong reactions. And I don't know, like I don't know what to make of these fan theories of Emilia Clarke was secretly pissed off about, you know, how her end and date, because like, you know, now that I've seen it, a lot of people saying, you know, because she basically said when people ask her what'd you think, she kind of made like a grimace face, but it's kind of like, is that because secretly I'm the villain and it's not that I don't like it, it's more of just like, oh, what a bummer that was, or if it's more like I hate this, I don't think it's in Daenerys's character. I don't know.
Yeah,
but it just goes back to like I This is the documentary you shoot, I feel like, to put a good face on something that is kind of broadly disappointing. And either they just got lucky doing that, or they knew and were intentionally shooting a documentary to put that brave face on it. I don't know. Anything else you want to say about the documentary?
I did think, you know, to kind of go along with that, it was sort of funny. Every time they showed somebody drinking a coffee, I was like, huh, one of those is going to end up on set. Or like...
It's like a Hitchcock thing, film. That's tension. That's some tension.
There's one thing where they talk about, you know, the TV constraints, and they say that they basically found the limits of this production, which to me implies that there were things they wanted to do that they couldn't do, and maybe things that they needed to do that they couldn't quite get done to their satisfaction. Mm-hmm. You know, and then that feeds back into, oh, well, season 8 was disappointing in a lot of ways, and... you know, how much of that was simply running up against the scope problem? Like, how big can we make this fucking thing on this budget and time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how to parse that, because I was trying to figure out the same thing. Like, are they saying that because, like, it's a good thing this is over because there was nowhere for this to go but down?
Right.
Or we found our limit and that means that we had to go back and, like, cut some things out, because, like, the other thing is there's another... We talked about this on, I think, the spoiler podcast, or maybe it was the podcast or the main episode of last week, where someone wrote in and said that there was some behind-the-scenes footage where Kit Harington slips on some snow and interrupts a line. Mm-hmm. But it was in the middle of him and Dany talking about how you control dragons. Like, what is the exactly the... Like literally in the middle, he slips and the line's blown. It's ha-ha, like a Kit. Or a Kit. He can't wink and he can't walk on snow. And in this, there was another section, a different section of dialogue from that scene also cut that was in this documentary. And I wonder how much got onto the cutting floor. And I also wonder why, because it didn't seem like they had to hit any particular runtime in any of this stuff. And Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what constrains it. Like, well, we'd like to put the scene in, but it requires 3 seconds of CGI, and we just don't got it. Like, we have, you know, to maintain continuity of all these fucking waterfalls, we got to get rid of... and the only one good scene we had, Kit slipped in, so we're fucked. Like, I wonder... That's why I would love to see something on editing and something on, like, you know, how many hours were shot versus how many hours did we get on the frame.
Yeah.
Or did we get on the TV? I don't know those answers, and I want to, because I'm trying to figure out where exactly is there like a 12-hour cut of this season that makes things make more sense?
I don't know.
I doubt it, because
weren't shooting to that.
Yeah,
they'd be shooting. Oh, maybe they run like an hour over in total on the season. But
yeah, it seems like the more expensive a production, the less extra footage you shoot, because you know you're going to have, like, if you're it's like, you know, you get your shots and you get your safeties and you got to move on, because what are you going to do? Take flyers on? Oh yeah, I'm going to do this, and we'll have to spend 30 seconds of CGI budget, which is going to be $3.7 million, and then we got to kill all the direwolves. So.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and we'll find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Okay. I want to move on to a point. I saw a discussion on Reddit, because people are kind of like, you know, this is what people are doing now, is trying to decide, you know, why are we disappointed? If we are disappointed, if we like it, why do we like it? How are we talking through these issues? And someone mentioned this episode of a podcast called Talk from Superheroes. And this fellow, one of the hosts named Andrew, this is episode 175 if you want to look it out. And it's like, I don't know, 30 minutes into his podcast, he talks about that there's this writing exercise that in between every story progression, in between every major plot point, a writer should be able to say because or therefore, and it should connect to something logically, preferably in the past and also towards the future, unless it's like the climax. And then, of course, you know, you don't have that. And if instead you are forced to write and then that's the first clue that you're kind of writing like a child does. Like a child doesn't think of like the history of the characters. They're just like, and then this guy finds a sword and then he goes and kills a dragon and then he becomes king. And then it's a fairy tale style of writing. And he went through a couple different examples. But if you look at like season one, you know, because Ned Stark loves his children, he compromises his integrity to falsely confess to treason. But because Joffrey's mother and father have kind of passively and actively raised him to be shallow and cruel, he goes off script and has Ned executed instead of sent to the wall. Therefore, the North is going to rise up and call its banners to get revenge. And because Robb chooses love over duty, he disregards his marriage alliance with the Freys. And because of this choice, his bannermen grew disillusioned with his campaign, therefore weakening his kingship. Therefore, the Red Wedding happens because Tywin's able to exploit this to bribe the Freys and the Boltons to betray Robb. And then you get into season eight, and it's like, and then Arya kills the Night King, and then they go to King's Landing, and then a dragon gets killed by a crossbow, and then another dragon kills all the crossbows, and then Dany burns the city. And it's not that there's no becauses there necessarily, but they're not as strongly connected. Like, the dragon gets killed by a crossbow. What is the thing that Dany does that avoids that? You know, and also, she had been shot by a crossbow before. What is the reason that she walked into his ambush off of Dragonstone, which is a fucking island just a few miles off the shore of King's Landing, the heart of the enemy empire? Like, and that's where it's like, I feel like this really neatly summed up what I thought was going on, that we lost all of this like unbroken chain of causality going back to Robert's Rebellion. And then we got substituted with just a whole bunch of these cool action points that didn't need any kind of reason. I mean, the most glaring thing is, best case scenario, we get a compelling reason for the Night King doing all this sometime in this season, the very last season of the show. I don't think we got that. We got in the second episode, we're going to use Bran as bait. Why? Well, because the Night King wants to end all stories. I don't know. That's just something I wanted to share because I thought it made some things click for me. Yes, this is kind of why I think the storytelling is weaker in seven and season seven and eight than it was in one through six. So, Hey, before we get further into the episode, I want to talk about what's going on here at baldmove.com this week. We periodically do a Q&A podcast to have people kind of ask us off the topic questions around certain events. And we had a milestone that we hit right as we started the Game of Thrones season, where we hit our 50 millionth download on podcasts. You can send your questions to qa@baldmove.com. We'll be recording that sometime next week and releasing it in the TV feed, the Bald Move TV feed. And you'll want to be subscribed to that anyway, because HBO has a hit on its hand. It is the fictionalized retelling of the Chernobyl disaster and the series Chernobyl. It's really good. We're giving it full weekly coverage in the Bald Move TV feed. You'll also want to be subscribe to that because of the Deadwood TV movie event that's releasing this Friday. If you're a big fan of HBO and a long-term fan of HBO, you know that Deadwood is one of their most beloved shows that didn't quite get the ending for various reasons, and had gone back to do a TV event, and I can't wait to see it. That comes out May 31st. That's this Friday evening, and we'll be talking about that next week. Also, on our Bald Movies feed, we have been going bananas lately. We just covered the live-action film Aladdin last week. This week, we'll be seeing Godzilla, King of Monsters. It looks really freaking cool. If you didn't get enough dragon and monster combat in Game of Thrones, well, you can get it on Godzilla, King of Monsters. That's going to be coming out in the Bald Movies podcast. You can find Bald Movies and Bald Move TV by searching for those things in your favorite podcast aggregator app. And then finally, on twitch.tv/baldmove, Jim and I will be playing our further misadventures in the Game of Westeros on Winter is Coming. And we'll also be premiering the first non-club airing of our old Telltale Game of Thrones playthroughs, will be playing two more episodes tonight. And then on Wednesday, as always, Cecily and I will be playing some co-op Mario action at twitch.tv/baldmove. That sounds like a good idea. Slot on over there, subscribe, and enjoy. Do you want to talk about predictions and score ourselves before we go on to feedback?
Yeah, let's do it.
I want to shout out Nick M, because he actually went through and compiled all these into a spreadsheet, into a spreadsheet, I think. And then Cecily went through and actually pulled the quotes where we made it, these predictions. So thanks to both of you for making this segment possible. Okay, so we had a couple of general ideas about the show. So these were like in a preamble. You said, I want to see the show to succeed. And that you actually found yourself in the bounds riveted by last season, season 7. And my thoughts were, I want to share with you my dream of a satisfactory ending, because all they have to do is do the big battles and the big scenes. How can they lose? I also said, I don't see any plot-based potholes that they will not be able to fill. I didn't foresee them introducing new ones.
Yeah, to be fair, I think they had all the tar and gravel they needed to fill those fucking holes.
Yeah, they did.
They just said, Department we'll leave those for next winter.
Department of Westeros Works had all the materials they needed. Also, and this is the one that really tickles me, I said, and I quote, I can't imagine the level of phoning in that would have to be done during the final season for it to be disappointing.
Yeah.
And I didn't imagine that 100% of the phoning in would come from the writing department.
Yeah. Man.
So they also here's a comment that I made that seems kind of accurate in retrospect. If there's going to be any pacing issues, I didn't expect any pacing issues, but if there're going to be any pacing issues, the longer episodes will exacerbate that. Or exacerbate.
Yeah.
And then you elaborated and said, if you have one 90-minute battle and then next week you have another 90-minute battle, it'll be like eating too much chocolate fudge. I definitely think there was a bit of that with these long battle sequences, and the fact that they seemed very unmotivated just made it worse.
Yeah, it was weird for me because I never felt like, oh, I've had my fill of battle sequences. Mm-hmm. What I felt was... And maybe it's because I was feeling like, why did that just happen in that second battle sequence? It was more like, by the time I realized there was a battle sequence happening, I had spent the first 10 minutes of it just trying to process why any of it was happening at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't registering as battle.
Right. So let's get to character prediction. So on Jon Snow / Aegon, you said, I think Jon is likely to die because there's not a place in this world for him. You actually were right. There was not a place for this world with him. He ends up getting banished to a land north of the wall, but he didn't die.
No.
Not physically. And I said, if I had to bet money, I'd say one of Jon or Daenerys doesn't make it through. So, and I said 50-50, like 100% for both of them, 50-50 for each cumulatively. So I think we both can kind of claim partial credit on that one. Tyrion, you said you see him with a Golden Girl style ending, Tyrion and Varys drinking wine and making jabs at each other.
Yeah, well, half of that might be true. It's just Tyrion and Bronn.
And the jabs, the last jab we got. The last good Tyrion Varys jab we got was another eunuch joke.
Yeah.
From the very beginning of the season, so that was nice. I said for Tyrion, there's no narrative purpose for him to die, and he didn't. And in fact, he's the hand of the king. So like, didn't see that happening with Bran, obviously, but him being like the head of state was something on both of our minds, I think. Jorah, you said him becoming the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch following the steps of Jorah would be kind of cool. I said he's destined to die in some kind of showy thing. For example, killing Varys in a murder-suicide. He did die in a showy way, for sure.
I don't know what so I have a list of, like, percentages.
Mm-hmm.
And none of these comments are lining up. I don't understand.
I'm just giving, because the percentages are, okay, I'll let me do this. I'll give the percentages first, and we'll do our commentary.
Okay.
So you said, Jim, you said 20% certain that John would die. 80% that he would live. Mm-hmm. I was 50-50 pending John or Danny. Daenerys, you were 100%, 0% sure she would die, 100% chance she would live. Tyrion, yeah. We both were 0% chance dying, 100% chance living. Varys, you were 0% chance on dying, 100% on living. I was 100% living, 0% of him dead. So I guess, yeah. Then where we're catching up. Jorah, you said 100% dies. I said 100% lives. So you got that one. Then Melisandre, you were 100% dies. I was 100% dies. Our commentary on that was that she would die in a fiery blaze, is what you said. And I joked that she would kill Varys and herself in an elaborate murder-suicide just to say, I was right about a prophecy. You also said her shadow babies will live on. And I predicted that she would die running all over the battlefield birthing shadow babies, sadly.
Wow.
Although, her running around the battlefield of Winterfell doing magic did happen.
That did happen, yeah.
It did happen.
Partial credit.
Partial credit. The Hound, you said, is saying 50% waffling? And then when I said yes, he said, then I'm opening a Waffle House and saying 50-50.
Right.
I said Sandor getting peace would be a satisfying conclusion, and peace could be defined as death, so I was I was cool with that. Let's see. That's the Hound. Sansa, we were both 100% sure that she would live.
Yeah, I think we did the Stark kids like as a group, and all of them were living.
Yeah. You said that she will be the Lady of Winterfell, and that's her place. Actually, you were wrong.
Pretty much.
You did the Price is Right thing, where you came closest to that overbidding.
Yeah.
Because she's actually queen in the North.
Yeah.
And then for Arya, let's see. We both were convinced 100% that she would live. You said that she's 100% she has to go south to try to kill Cersei, which you were correct on. I predicted
didn't really
she would
get a chance, but yeah.
Right. I predicted she would join the King or Queen's Guard. Because I had this theory of like an all badass ladies Queen's Guard for Dany, which was hilariously wrong on multiple counts.
Yeah.
I also joked that once she crosses the last name off her list, which I thought would be Cersei, Jaqen would uncloak off her starboard bow and kill her for betraying the Faceless Men. Bran, okay, this is a 0% chance that he'd die and 100% chance he'd live for both of us. You said he'd end up under the weirwood tree in Winterfell, and I said he would be obliterated in a psychic battle with the king with King's Land in with
the
with king. The Night's King rather. So neither one of those. It's funny, we both said that he would live. But yes, we kind of predicted a kind of a death. Like, I guess you'd say merging with the tree would not be an actual death.
Yeah, not for a three-eyed raven.
Jamie, you said there's 80% chance he dies. I was 20% chance 20% chance lives. I was 100% chance he would die.
I was hoping with that 20% that he would go in and kill Cersei, and you know, he might make it out, but no.
I predicted that he might be the one that kills the Night King because that would make him the Kingslayer times two.
Mm-hmm.
And the saving the realms of men from evil bastards twice. Brienne, we predicted both that she would live 100%. And some choice quotes were, it'd be super fitting if she just ended up by Sansa's side, essentially serving as her mountain. And then I said that there's going to be a lot of weddings, and it'd be like the Lord of the Rings, Return of the King ending, except for every time you fade to black, there'd be a new fucking marriage starting. Tormund, we both had a shrug emoji for living or dying.
Who cares?
Yeah, and you said that he will end up in Castle Black, which...
Oh, yeah, kind of.
Actually was kind of, sort of, like until his best bro, John, came back, and he decided... I think John, as his last act of Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, disbanded the Night's Watch.
Maybe, yeah.
He's like, it's stupid. It shouldn't be. We're just going to go north. Bronn, we said 100% chance he would live or die, you thought. 100% chance he'd live for me.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And then I said, Bronn is the cockroach with the heart of gold. And
yeah.
Now he's got... literal gold because he sits on one of the richest kingdoms in the Seven Kingdoms. Sam, our official prediction was you said 50-50 live or die, you Waffle Housed again. I said 100% chance he lives, and our commentary was he's going to die. You said he's going to die in his belief that he needs to protect these people. And to be fair, he did die 7 times in the Battle of Winterfell.
Yeah, they just didn't show us that.
Yeah, he just kept they just kept forgetting in a blatant continuity error. He kept on being alive in the next scene. I said he's going to have one more unit of combat with his stolen Valyrian steel sword, or we'll give it to someone. Ding, ding. We also kind of rolled our predictions for Gilly and Baby Sam into those. Theon, our official prediction was that he was going to die. Both of us are 100% on that. You said it'd be more bittersweet if Theon saves Yara and kills Euron somehow. That partial credit. He did save Yara.
He did, yeah. Took about 45 seconds of screen time.
Mm-hmm.
I think saved Yara.
I think that's how we both, as I said, he's going to go in and single-handedly best Euron in combat to save Yara, which that was like a question mark because I was not buying him being that badass of a warrior, but, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yara, our predictions officially were 100% lives for both of us. You said she'd either be dead or a captive of Euron. And I said that Theon will save her and redeem himself in some kind of heroic sacrifice.
Wait, I said she was either dead at that point.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah, that was not a prediction. That was a recap.
More waffling from the waffle. No. I also thought that she would be part of the Queen's Guard, the badass all-women Queen's Guard. That didn't happen. Let's see. Cersei. I think we're both 100% that she would die, that is true. Our commentary was... there's nothing sweet about Cersei living through all this. You thought that she tricked Tyrion and Jaime into thinking that she's pregnant. Whether she's pregnant or not, we have no way of knowing. It could be a quote-unquote hysterical pregnancy. It could be just her making shit up. It could be that she's actually... But whatever. I think the show's official point of view was that she's pregnant.
I think so, yeah.
I said that 300% sure that she's dead. So, let's see. I also predicted that she would actually become pregnant, give birth, and this baby would be raised as John and Danny's because that was neatly sidestep Danny's fertility problem. Hilariously wrong on that. Euron, we were both 100% sure he would die. I predicted that this would go down in some kind of war with the Golden Company and elephants. Let us know the elephants. The elephants that they threw in that scene when they realized they didn't have enough money to render elephants in the Battle of King's Landing. So they went back and had Cersei being very disappointed. Night's King, both 100% sure he would die. You said there's no sweet at all in a bittersweet pot if a Night King prevails. And then I suggested that there was a plot line where 6 different people would combine to kill the Night King. Bran distracts with this psychic warfare. Jon faints with the sword. Gendry gores him with his fucking bull helmet, and Arya sneaks in with her mask. Nope, just Arya. Yeah. Arya sneaks in, no mask.
Yeah, sneaking with a leaping, screaming attack from behind.
Yeah, I always liked in like Assassin's Creed to do a stealth kill where I'd jump off the roof of a third floor, and land on some guy giving a speech in a public square and just like, you know, do this flying tackle. And yeah, it's stealth.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't see that coming. Gendry, we said, I don't have the percentages on this one.
No,
but we said that he might smelt an armor out of dragonglass, which turns out we were joking that that's impossible, but he started smelting weapons out of dragonglass. So
yeah.
We said that he might come into play if you needed to like break glass in case John and Danny both die, because he would have a strong claim to the throne. He said, what if you made a suit of armor out of dragon glass? And I said, it'd be like the Night King fighting as a wasp, someone with a suit made out of raid. So then, last one, Nymeria. You said that, I said it'd be nice, since they went to the trouble of rendering her in adult form, that she should return from River Run with her pack and whoop some ass at the Battle of Winterfell. You said you can go to gemofthrones.com to read my fanfic, which is Bran as Nymeria being ridden by Arya. It's 4 pages long. It's $2.99. It's essentially the last 4 minutes of the podcast. And turns out there's actually a gemofthrones.com where you can read his fanfic of Nymeria and Bran warging into her. And it is indeed just a transcript of that part of the podcast. So,
all right. I got to look this up.
How you think Oh, also, the chances of Jim reading a book, reading the books to find more about the White Walkers, 100% chance that theory would die.
Yeah.
Given by
did.
Jim. And it did.
The cruelest of deaths.
Lo, it came to pass. So there, how do you think we did overall?
I think we did pretty well.
Yeah.
I think you nailed the big two, right? The 50-50 either or of Dan and Johnny.
But I didn't see it.
Dan and Johnny.
Yeah, you finally did it.
Jan and Donnie.
But not obviously in the way that it happened.
No, but I mean, the idea was correct that both of them, you know, the world wasn't big enough for the both of them, essentially. Yeah. And then, you know, some of the characters around the edges, I think we nailed the Starks. We nailed a lot of the big ones.
Yeah. Which I think adds kind of like legitimacy to the argument. It's like, look, we're not disappointed at how this ended. I think we were kind of up for anything. It's more of like, you know, like we win. It's like we win away from the because, therefore, to the and then and then and then. And there's just only so much of that you can take before like it is no longer the thing you fell in love with. So were you looking up something or should we?
I was looking at Jim of Thrones.com.
Yeah. So Cecily threw that together. I don't know when. Yeah. Sometime in before the last 24 hours for sure. Yeah, Jim of Thrones. Check it out. Before we get to feedback, one final time, I want to talk about the club at club.baldmove.com. It's essentially how we paid most of our bills around here. It's a great way to support independent podcasts, and you get a lot of bonus features. One thing that we're going to be kicking off that we do periodically is something we call the Empire Business, where we talk about the highs and lows of running a podcast startup, and we go behind the scenes, talk about our checkbooks, our balance books, our ledger, our spreadsheets, mm-hmm. our money, our financial situation. We talk about new initiatives we're trying. We explain how podcast advertising works. We debate new club features and whatnot. We're going to be kicking off a new season of that that's going to last several episodes. So if you're interested in any kind of behind-the-scenes looks of an internet startup, a podcast startup, if that's something interesting to you, you can get a whole bunch of information existing right now. We're starting a new season in the weeks or two, the weeks ahead. All that can be found at club.baldmove.com. In fact, you can preview a lot of these features, the video features. You can test drive them for free. You get more information from them on that page, and you can sign up for a free 30-day trial just by going to club.baldmove.com. Okay, feedback. This is the last feedback that we are doing for Game of Thrones, but we are also going to be covering the prequels. We'll also be, I know for a fact, I'll be back at least to talk about Fire and Blood later this year. Of course, if Winter comes out, if we get some significant news on the new prequels, if a trailer comes out, like come to this feed. It'll probably be renamed. It'll have a different some cover art on it, but it's going to be the exact same feed. This is going to be all of George Martin stuff on HBO going forward. So Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. I imagine we'll probably rename that too, but it'll probably always redirect. Anyway, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. We've got some final thoughts. We'll read them off air. Here we go first. Arthur M., where and how do I get a copy of the Game of Thrones theme podcast music you use? I love it. So,
by a guy called Highway Superstar on SoundCloud.
Yeah, he's kind of blown up in the last few years. He's got if you search for Highway Superstar, he's got a Wikipedia article, and there's, like, you know, articles written about him, and he had this thing called Game of Thrones, the 80s TV theme remix, and if you go to any of our articles about Game of Thrones, it's at the bottom. There's a link to that. But if you search for just Highway Superstar, you'll find a SoundCloud, and you can download a lot of his music. I know this one in particular as an MP3, because when I forget... When I'm trying to produce one of these at home and I don't have the assets, I can just go to his site, download it, and snip out the first 15 seconds, and boom, you got a podcast. And really much appreciate him letting us use excerpts from that song, because I really, you know, I think it gave a nice bow tie for the podcast.
For sure.
So there you go. Amanda C., I think the worst thing about the finale is the lessons it tells. I feel like the most important part of any work of art is the moral message it teaches. So, what's the lesson of Game of Thrones? That if you're ever in an abusive relationship, not only will you never be able to enjoy a healthy, respectful one, but also your abuser will literally take you down with them. That if you have an abusive parent, you cannot escape that fate and will be exactly like them. Even if you've never met them, have spent years building a support network, and repeatedly worked through your decisions to pick the most morally good ones. In the end, I feel like the Double D's were so concerned with the spectacle and foreshadowing, they don't think they even stopped to consider what message they were sending. I mean, yes, I don't think Dan and Dave, like, whatever message is in Game of Thrones in the early goings was the message that George put there. And I think they are very incurious about any kind of societal message that they send or do. They're all about, is it a cool story?
Huh. Yeah, man. I just, how much do I speculate on these guys?
I mean, we've known them for 10 years. We don't know them, but they put out a product of work for the last 10 years. And it might not be fair, but you can definitely say things about them based on what they're putting out there publicly.
Yeah, and I think about, you know, the other show that they wanted to do, this retelling of American history involving the Civil War and slavery, and, like, I can't imagine you go into a show like that with zero interest in any societal statements.
That's a good point.
Because if you do, then, well, I don't even think you come up with the idea to make that show. Mm-hmm. Unless you've seen, like, Man in the High Castle, and then decided, hey, we could do that, but with the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many wars. Oh, my God. We could do this with every war. Which one's cool? Civil War.
Yeah.
So clearly they think about those things, but whether that made it into Game of Thrones or not, I'm not sure, because ultimately it's not their story, right? They're just kind of trying to do justice to whatever outline they had from George.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm kind of with you. I don't think they considered it much.
I don't even think they considered, if you take the moral lesson and, like, what it says about society, like, just at the end of this, do you think, like, when they're done a script, do you think they did one last, like, is this bittersweet? Is this maintaining the tone that we think that the original is going to have? Because I don't know. Like, a lot of stuff, like we talked about, Bran sitting on the throne. That seems like a kind of cool thing for one of the Stark kids to do. This guy who thought he was never going to be able to be a knight or never be able to sit a horse, and now he's sitting on what it used to be called, the Iron Puddle at this point. There's a lot of problems with the way he sat on it and the powers he has, and what will that mean for Westeros and him as a human? And
yeah,
the fact
fair.
That is that even Bran Stark anymore? And he wasn't at the beginning of the season, but now he's at, like, there's a lot of sinister things there. And I don't think they ever kind of, like, okay, like almost feels like the second they got a coherent plot mechanics that would get them to the final bullet point that George gave them, if indeed that's what they did, then they're like, okay, we're done. We can quit now. I don't know. Then thinking about, like, what theme or what lesson or what the youth of America or the world will learn from watching this, I don't think was anywhere on their radar. Okay, Kevin H. I'm gonna assume it's gonna be Kevin Hart, and I appreciate celebrity feedback. I had a thought about the Night's Watch remaining intact and the lack of explanation on the show for why the institution remains. For centuries, since the longer night, the Night Watch stood as a colony of criminals guarding the realm from, essentially, wildlings. Without the Night's Watch, the wildlings would mate at south of the Wall, but who in the Seven Kingdoms would have believed the White Walkers had risen, even if relations with the wildlings had been relatively peaceful? Should a White Walker resurgence or some other extinction-level threat arise in the real North, it could realistically wipe out those living north of the Wall, assuming they attempted a last stand or were unaware of the threat in time to retreat and continue south without the Seven Kingdoms having any warning. No matter how far down the timeline this may occur, it seems worth keeping those towers manned into perpetuity. Just in case, it might be worth running a hose on that broken Eastwatch portion for a few decades while they're at it. I don't see there being much to lose by continuing to banish criminals through the Wall, if not just to keep an eye out on things. So this is kind of like, I remember, like, listening to, like, Dan Carlin's Hardcore History podcast series on the Mongols and Genghis Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I took away many things in that series, but one is, like, back in antiquity, the idea that there is an unknown out there, like, we don't guard our border. We don't guard our borders to Canada because we're friends, right? But if Canada was just an empty, vast expanse, and you didn't have radar and, you know, like spy satellites and stuff, just assuming that no one's up there and no one will ever be up there, and no one will ever will come is like super fucking dangerous, right? Because that's how like all these powers got taken over by Genghis Khan. Like they didn't even think that there would be a people out there, let alone something as relatively sophisticated as the Mongols. So I think what he's saying here, Kevin, is that like defending this unknown border is something that you would want to do regardless. Like unless you're 100% sure the White Walkers are dead and there's no species that would ever threaten you again, or there's no weird land bridge from another part that some other civilization might come and conquer you through, that you should keep that border defended. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, ice spiders alone.
The ice spiders
are
right.
Scary enough to keep me on the Night's Watch.
Yeah, yeah. You got to keep the mastodon, the woolly mammoths, and the ice bears and ice spiders, all that stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, I think like even the sort of headcanon-y reason of like, well, they need some place to send the prisoners, or people who are no good for this world, might as well keep the Night's Watch open. That works for me, but yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense too.
Ann W. had a couple other thematic things she wanted to talk about. In her opinion, John did fulfill the Azor Ahai prophecy because, in a way, he did defeat the darkness. Now, we did talk about this on the spoiler edition, but I'm going to do kind of a paraphrasing for this since everything's all said and done now. The darkness was not just a long night as we thought, but really more of a threat to the innocent. He was the one who defeated the darkness when he led the fight against the Night's King, who then literally turned into ice water. He then went to fight what he thought was the next threat to the people, Cersei, a lion, and finally realized he had to defeat the biggest threat of all to save the people, his love. Now, Anne is referring to a prophecy about Azor Ahai, the Nissa Nissa prophecy, which said that to forge Lightbringer, the sword, the magic sword that was going to turn to darkness, that this Azor Ahai smelted this sword for many, many days. He tried to quench it in water like you do, and it shattered. Then he worked on it for twice as long, and he tries to quench the sword in the heart of a lion, and it shatters. And with sadness, he realizes what he must do. And now he smiths this thing for four times as long as original, and he plunges it. He quenches it in the heart of his wife, Nissa Nissa.
And it shatters, and he's like, oh, goddamn it.
And he's like, fuck, this just, I'm a bad blacksmith.
No,
my
it does not shatter.
Steel is so brittle. It can't
maybe it's
handle
a different part of the process that's yeah causing this.
He's smelting dragon glass is just tricky. Only Gendry has mastered the art.
What if that doesn't work?
Right. I mean,
what if you plunge the sword in the heart of your wife? What makes you think that the lion's heart was not good enough and the wife's heart would be?
Well, that's the thing is, like, this prophecy is very like a biblical prophecy. And like, if you've read the Bible, you know, because it's some of this prose is thousands of years old. Not the best narrative sometimes. And I feel like that's like there is
but
no
normally in the Bible they get visits from the Lord or something.
Yeah.
Like if the mother and the warrior, like all
right,
if the seven gods come down to him and all tell him you need to quench this in your wife's heart,
right?
Sure, I could see maybe following that advice, but just to get the hair, the yeah wild hair, like ah,
he intuited it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's a weird thing.
Yeah, but no, I mean, this, like I said, thematically, this does work, and it wouldn't be surprised. It wouldn't surprise me at all if this works thematically, because this is actually, in broad strokes, kind of what Martin, like, this is his clever way of making this Azor Ahai stuff all track through. I think, you know, you need a little bit more explanation to justify, like things he doesn't have an agency over. Like if Arya kills Night King in the book, then how does Jon get credit for that?
Yeah,
unless he's like a joint, like, you know, some kind of joint effort, like I was joking about, that like several people had to, and Arya's the one that lands the killing stroke. But yeah, it kind of like if you squint and you don't think too hard about it, like that all lines up: the water, the lion, and then the lover's heart. Boom. Mm-hmm. When Tyrion sees the body of Jaime and Cersei, he picks up some odd bricks and starts banging them together in grief and frustration. I thought that was a nice callback to the story he told about his cousin, Orson, banging beetles with a rock, the sentiment being that these deaths are so senseless and cruel for him, especially as Tyrion had tried so hard to save them throughout the last two seasons. Yeah, I haven't seen anybody point this out, and I thought that was pretty good, because it's very consistent with the kind of thunk, the mindless death and killing that the cousin Orson was doing with his beetles. I don't know if the Double D's were trying for that, because that's like that's something they invented for the show. That cousin Orson talk doesn't happen in the book, so it did seem one of the things on their agenda was all the shit that they had put in, like, you know, the prophecy about the eye colors, like all that stuff was going to be significant, and it was all going to pay off by God. So this is consistent with that, Ann. Moving on. Kathy P., in regards to the Jamie storyline, it has bothered me that a general consensus seems to be that the last two episodes ruined his long-coming redemption arc. I disagree. Jamie's redemption arc is in fact simply, or is intact simply by everything he has done in the past few seasons. I might even argue that Jamie has always been redeemed, but his ego and reputation just got in the way of that. To the viewer, he went from someone who pushes a kid out of the window for Cersei to someone who humbled himself to fight under Brienne and chose to do the right thing during the Great Battle in North. But as we learned in the brilliant hot tub scene, Jaime killed the Mad King for good reason, for the greater good of the people. The public shift towards revealing the good person that Jaime always was underneath his ego came when he lost his fighting hand. Though being seen as weak for the first time in his gold-plated life, he was put in a place of being humbled, similar to what Tyrion has lived with his entire life. I'd argue that they are very similar to the core and always have been. His choice to return to Cersei does not dampen this arc, or whatever it's called, revealing Jaime's true good nature. He returned to the side of his sister and mother of his children. He's proving his loyalty to her, almost in the same way that Brienne had a loyalty to Catelyn Stark. Returning to Cersei, in my view, only makes his arc stronger. He chose duty and loyalty over happiness, which also reinforces the theme of family that's echoed throughout the series. The pack survives, which is the Stark's motto, and Cersei is like Jaime's family, or is Jaime's family. What do you think about this take?
I mean, I'm glad that you can reconcile those things. I think that a character's final disposition in a show is the definitive stamp on who they were, and I think returning to Cersei shows that the betrayal of not fighting for the living was not one that was strong enough for him not to continue loving her. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is a return to old Jaime, who would do despicable, horrible things. Mm-hmm. Like if they live, let's say Jaime and Cersei live, and Jaime's put to another test where he has to murder somebody to protect Cersei's an innocent or paralyze a child, the end of this show tells me that he will do that again.
Yeah.
No problem. And that was not the Jaime that I was coming to terms with.
Yeah, and I just don't buy this, like, Kathy's thesis, which I agree the show does focus on the importance of family. But the whole, like, blood being thicker than water, and, like, you know, the, like, loyalty to some your family is admirable in and of itself. Like, I think, like, loyalty to any ideal or any institution is only as admirable as that institution or idea is. Mm-hmm. Like, loyalty to tyranny is bullshit. You know, loyalty to injustice is terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, if your family has loved you and done right by you, and, or, you know, like, you know, we're all imperfect people, but, like, you know, be loyal to your family, that's fine. But if your loyalty is a bunch of murderous thugs, then disloyalty to them is actually like loyalty to the greater kind of, you know, human spirit, or the mass of humanity. So I don't think Game of Thrones is like family, like the story is family is important. It's more like, I mean, yeah, like it's not above all, though, right?
No, it can't be.
Yeah.
I mean, no, certainly not.
So, like, yeah, so that's why I guess I was disappointed that, like, I didn't think that his family earned his loyalty. Even Tywin, like, the loyalty is a two-way street. Like, you have to do what's best for the family. What's best for the family is to have a dynasty and to be in power and respected, not that you have healthy dynamics, not that your family is happy, not that they're necessarily even prosperous, not that the realm is prosperous, just that you're on top of it all, mm-hmm. always. And that's a hollow ideal, and I don't think is satisfying in some kind of redemption arc. Richard, did the new process of selecting the king really break the wheel? As I remember or understood the wheel, it was a process where a select number of houses were the spokes, and the wheel would roll with different houses rising to the top while crushing those underneath. Granted, the new process will be less violent. However, it's still the most powerful houses selecting who will rule over the others. I would argue that the wheel remains unbroken.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing this does is introduce some kind of elective process for choosing a new king. And you can kind of extrapolate from that and say, okay, well, maybe, you know, hundreds, thousands of years from now, they might end up on a system a lot like what we have here in America or in Europe, in many other nations, where people actually elect the leaders that govern them.
Right.
And I think this is like a micro baby step toward it, but it's an important one. So it sort of leaves you hopeful at the end of this series that something is going to change, even if it's not completely 100% changed and perfect right now.
Yeah, and I think the reason that it feels kind of unsatisfying is like all the reasons, like, you know, if they sat Bran on the throne and everyone agreed to it, that'd be fine. But like the thing went fucked as soon as Sansa said, well, what about the North? Because the North could get special treatment. Every single lord sitting there could say that. Like, you know, some of these houses fucking went extinct. Like, Bronn's there, and there's no Martells, or not Martells, there's no Tyrells left. There's no Martells left that we recognize. I guess there's some fourth cousin that spiffied up, got the Sunspear on, and arrived in the delegation, but like it felt hollow because half the people there we didn't know. The other, like a third of the people that were there that we did know, probably didn't have any standing to be voting there, and they turn it into kind of a joke, but like that's not funny. And yeah, like, okay, let's say Bran lives for a long time and he rules and he doesn't have children, and it's 50 years later and he finally dies or merges with the Force or whatever he does. How do these lords pick a new king? Like, and Nell says Edmure just put himself forward for the entire kingship. The fact that he wouldn't instantly be like, well, I should be king of the rivers now. I don't know. That's why I feel like that, yes, it doesn't feel like it broke the wheel, because we don't know the mechanics of how they'll actually resolve the differences. They're saying, like, this is how we're going to do it, but that's like, you know, saying that, like, if you know, you're going to get two groups of you're going to get a group of 10 friends, and instead of fighting about where you go to dinner every night, all 10 of you will agree where you go to dinner on Friday nights. Well, what happens if one person wants steak and everybody else wants Chinese? How do you resolve that? What's the mechanics? Like, it was superficial and not in depth enough, and also didn't feel like a big enough change. I think those are some of the problems I had with it anyway. Because it does feel like, yeah, what I'm getting at is in 50 years, unless everyone agrees on the new king, it's going to be fucking war, which is kind of what you had anyway, except for you had an ironclad, this is how things are done, and you got it, like, the only alternative to this automatic happening is war. So now you've got a process that adds chaos and confusion in that, and also the alternative to it is war. It did feel kind of unsatisfying. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Brent K, overall, the last two seasons of Game of Thrones have been a bit of a bummer, and it's easy to point at the writing as the main culprit, but I think the worst thing that happened to the show over the final several seasons was the Dor episode. The Hodor twist was such a shock and one of the most amazing twists I've seen in any TV show, but it's also a catalyst for so many insane fan theories and ended up leading to the subprime fan theory crisis of 2017 and 2019. Everyone started expecting too many shocking twists, which then never came, and the disappointment was inevitable. I think once that happened, the expectations for Bran's character went through the roof. Is he the Night King? Will he warg into the dragon? Is there more time travel? The possibilities were endless. All the theorizing spiraled out of control and did nothing but set the table for disappointment.
Interesting. Yeah, that was certainly something that was heavily discussed at the time. Like, right after this whole Hodor, Hold the Door thing happened, everybody's like, okay, what are the extents of Bran's powers? What kind of being does this make him? What does that imply for the future of this story? And honestly, they did as little as humanly possible with any of that. They used it to prove one plot point true, which was, you know, Jon is a Targaryen. But beyond that, they sort of ignored it. Mm-hmm. And that's the worst part of this, is that they ignored it.
Yeah.
They didn't say, okay, what are the logical conclusions of this character's newfound abilities, the things that we now understand he can do and he understands he can do, and let's write to that. They said, okay, we got to write to the end of this story, and sort of ignored all those things.
Yeah, a lot of that. Like, same thing with Arya's, like, face-swapping powers. There's a lot of, yeah, like, seeming things that seemingly were handmade to do something cool and mind-blowing in the final twist. Mm-hmm. And yet we got pretty conventional endings all around.
Yeah.
You know, like, even the dragonglass, curiously, didn't really... Like, everyone had dragonglass weapons, so it's just essentially a way to make the combat with the dead essentially be like it's combat with the living. If you can stick them with this pointy thing, they die. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now they're just like people. And the Valyrian steel... That was kind of cool, but you didn't see, like, there was never, like, a one-on-one with Jon or even Jorah that had a Valyrian steel weapon where it really kind of made a difference. I mean, Jorah got to Boromir his way to Dany's heart, but, I don't know. It did seem like that threw a lot of fuel on the theory fire. Like, all these ways, and I've talked about this consistently, that, like, that can be dangerous, because if you engineer a show where anything can happen, then, like, the writers can sometimes go crazy and just, you know, plot mechanics something out of their ass, because you've got all these crazy powers that can fit together in infinite ways, and here's one of them, and that can feel unsatisfying. I never in a million years thought they'd run the other way and just, like, okay, all this canon that we built up that can be tricksy and make people's faces change and stature change and can shift time and space and manipulate information, that's just not going to be important.
Yeah, I mean, so many of those things I feel like you could have got around with, like, character motivation, a little bit more fleshing out of that, right? Like, if Bran was just the type of person who realized, look, I can't interfere here, or you know, you could Doctor Strange it, right? There's a lot of ways to, like, make the character refuse to use their powers, and have that make a lot of sense in the story. Like, Arya, I don't know if she somehow, like, decided, no, this is not the person I want to be, and these face powers are part of something else in a past life that I no longer want. Like, you can get there to limit the powers of these seemingly limitless characters, but they just didn't even try and do any of that.
Yeah.
Which is the worst part. And it's interesting to frame it as, like, you know, the speculation, the theory crafting is what got out of hand. I disagree. I think the theory crafting, that door was not held. That door was kicked wide the fuck open, and Dan and Dave were desperately trying to hold it, but they weren't either. Like, nobody was at the door trying to hold it. There was shit, like, all of these horrible things were rushing in, and everybody was just ignoring them.
Yeah. But that's George's problem in a microcosm.
Yeah,
like, look
that's
how
tough.
Fucking cool the state of the board is. It's amazing. Okay, what's the end?
Yeah.
And all preferably make it be an end that no random jackass on the internet has ever guessed before.
Right.
Which I think George has given up. He revealed it 5 years ago that, like, his current understanding of how things would end was guessed by some obscure, like, as, and he's like, well, then I was faced with, what do I do? Do I change it? Or I'm like, no, I'm just going to tell the story the best I can. If he still feels that way, I don't know. But, like, yeah, and you're right. Like, it's curious that they went and did that with Hodor. Like, why not just change that? You know, like, why introduce this concept of, like, some kind of mental time travel or being able to affect things in the past and, like, this causality and have people thinking Back to the Future and Terminator and all this other shit when that was not going to make a difference? And other thing is, like, you said that, like, it's not that the powers didn't, like, Bran was fully warging in that battle, but as far as we know, he was just using it to get to get a crow's eye view of the Night King.
Yeah,
which he was
which
not
helped,
going to oppose in any way at all.
Yeah. I don't get it, man.
So, yeah. Anim, wondered if you guys can comment on how the actors themselves shaped the way the series has progressed. It seems like the show is also shaped by the actors, many of whom were hired as kids and luckily turned out to be pretty good. I'm not so sure about the actor that played Bran. Were his lines poorly written, or were they limited because they would have fallen flat on delivery? How much secret ambition and inner tension can be conveyed with a blank stare? On the other side of it, actors like Kit Harington had the charisma that exceeded the noble but dumb character he was supposed to portray, leaving people very invested in him and his fate. Although I'll say that, like, people's mileage on Jon Snow varied. Like, I was listening to some back when I was listening to a lot of podcasts before the season, there was a lot of people that this thought that Jon was just, you know, he broods. He's a brooder.
Yeah,
he's a
I don't think
brooder.
Jon was anybody's favorite character, despite what Andrew McClay says in the documentary.
He's a Stark bannerman. What is he
yeah,
supposed to
fair.
Say?
But yeah, Jon Snow, that's one of the things that struck me in that documentary is how sort of emotionally intelligent you can see Kit Harington is. Like, his reactions to these readings are one of someone who is deeply emotional, and none of that comes through in Jon Snow. And so, like, he's doing a really good job acting that character as, you know, someone who doesn't let those things get to him. But, like, you do get the impression that, man, they could have done so much more with Kit Harington that they just didn't do because of the character he's playing.
Well, I just think, so there's a couple things about Isaac Hempstead Wright. Is that his name?
Yeah.
Because before I defend him, I want to get his name right. You're only as good as what you've got to do and how you're directed. Like, for example, Natalie Portman, I think, is a fantastic actor, but she's terrible in the prequels. But if you watch behind the scene footage, she was doing exactly what she was told to do. Like, yeah. Like, Lucas had this idea that this child queen would be like, that's like a socially conditioned to not have emotion and to be regal and to like,
I just saw Aladdin. Come on.
Yeah. All this stuff. And so, like, she did what she was supposed to do. Like, if she did more than that, she wouldn't be doing her job. And I think for a long time, like, you know, while you think about, like, what Sophie Turner was allowed to do, what Maisie Williams was allowed to do, what material they're given, like, Bran was
riding around on Hodor's back, being pulled by Mira, and then the last two seasons, you're supposed to understand he's this otherworldly creation that can't even wrap his head around his own humanity. And I think that that performance is what is what you wanted to for that. That was what he was asked to do.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, like all these others, like we're having these like betrayals and you know, getting sold off and getting hijacked and getting murdered and being raised from the dead and raising armies and losing armies and undergoing intense training. I don't know. So I don't want to. He seems like a good enough guy. It's just like what would be a compelling way to play Bran as written?
Yeah, can you just not write characters like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's not super interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And then certainly not elevate to that person, because that's the other thing. Is like his. I do feel like this. Like the. I thought my search for Spock analysis was pretty right on. And that they wanted to set like Star Trek VI Spock on the throne, but they were at Search for Spock levels of his character development. So they just had Bran start cracking wry jokes at the end to desperately imply that he's kind of enough there that someone might sit him on the throne and everybody. But it's just ridiculous because like even Tyrion's like, who has the best story here? Any four of those people could have raised their hands and put their hat in a ring with Bran. You know, like Arya's probably like yeah. John and Arya are probably the two most incredible people still left on the board, but Sansa too, like her, like what is special about him? You know, like John fucking came back from the dead.
Yeah.
So,
and unified, formerly ununifiable force,
right,
against the Night King to right. ultimately defeat them.
Because, you know, Tyrion didn't say who knows the most about all of human knowledge. He said who has the best story. And I don't know. Michael S. And this is the last email. Has there been any other hit TV shows who had a final season as bad as Game of Thrones? I have not seen one, but I want to ask you, the TV experts. In terms of how good the rest
Wire.
In terms of
no.
You know, some people say season 5 is a bit of a disappointment.
Well, compared to the stellar 1-4, yeah, sure, but
in terms of how good the rest of the series was, can you say how this could have been known as the worst final season in the history of television when compared to how good the rest of the series was? So, I did some thinking, and I did some perusal of other people's lists, and I kind of compiled one, and it seems like there's two ways to make it disappointing a series of television. Like one is it's divisive and that like some people say, oh, it's really amazing or it's worth the joy, and then others you know, hate it. Then there's some that are kind of universally reviled, and then there's some that like have a slow decline and they switch showrunners. And you know, this show does feel like a show to almost switch. If I told you that in between season 7 and 8 that the Double D's were fired and they brought on some jobber to finish Game of Thrones, and that's why it's 18 months, you know, over schedule and all that stuff. And that's what, like, that would make a lot of fucking sense.
It could, yeah.
But that's not what happened. But that sometimes happens. Like, showrunners get too expensive or main cast members get fired. So here's kind of a list of, like, a consensus list of disappointing seasons of television or series of television. House of Cards. I don't think House of Cards ever started off as an A+. Was a pretty satisfying, trashy B+, and where they get to, and you know, this was a double whammy that like showrunners changed, the show was renewed past its natural, like this thing had a 3-season expiration date, it made it to 6, its main star was fired and fucking disgraced to where they couldn't even use his likeness in the final season. It's like everything possible could go wrong. The House of Cards is hilarious to watch, but it's not good. So that there's one of them. True Blood, again, not the world's greatest show, but it was pretty trashy, B+ fun, and it had one of the worst, most insulting, find a way to piss off every faction of the fan base endings possible. X-Files was considered excellent up until its movie, and then Chris Carter had. Almost like George Martin, everything had gotten bigger. Everything got bigger. This, like, oh, you thought it was just this. Now it's aliens. Oh, you thought it was just aliens. Now there's another alien faction. You thought, like, and it ended up being a big pile of shit. All of its main cast retired or left. And I don't even know how that thing ended because I bailed at season six, seven. Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, I think that's more divisive.
This isn't a divisive
camp.
Yeah,
because I like it.
Yeah.
I like it quite a bit.
But there's a lot of people that thought, like, and I didn't see the final season, but there's a lot of people that thought that it was kind of, it felt cheap. It didn't feel like it was earned or it was building up to something, and they were disappointed. It
has a big twist ending, sure.
Similar to Lost.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another huge divisive one.
Lost is a show that kept getting bigger and bigger, started in involving time travel, and like there are all these mechanical options. And then, again, I didn't see this one because I saw where this was going in season two, infamously, and bailed, but that's one of them. I saw this was a lid that made a lot of people's like top 10 list. Weeds, the final season of Weeds. You've seen the whole series, did you?
I've seen the whole series a couple times. I can't remember the final season. The show got weird around like season five. After Nancy gets out of prison, that show gets really weird. And in a not like normal weird Weeds way. But I don't remember the finale especially.
Yeah. Well, that might be a problem. Yeah. Dexter, infamously. I've not seen the final several seasons of Dexter. But
after the John Lithgow season, everything went downhill.
Yeah, and I guess like the particular finale was kind of reviled in infamy for how it left the main character. Mad Men was a pretty divisive finale for a very well-regarded top five golden age of television show.
Yeah, I mean, this is almost like a Jaime Lannister-type subversion of expectations where you really, really want that character to be changed.
Right.
And then the ending leaves you potentially dissatisfied.
Mm-hmm. I was not one of those. I thought that was a really good finale, but it was certainly divisive. And then like the granddaddy, pre-Golden Age, Saint Elsewhere, which I've not seen any of this, but I understand that's a hospital procedural that eventually ended on the final episode of speculating that all of the stories that just went on in the show were in the mind of a mentally disabled boy who was staring at a snow globe that happened to have this hospital as its center.
Yeah.
Which, on the one hand, that is total horseshit, and I can't believe anybody trotted that out as, like, a finale. Like, why, instead of having, like, all the, you know, why end on that? But then also, it's a procedural, so, like, who gives a shit? You can just, like, the great thing about procedurals is you can pretend entire episodes don't exist, entire plot lines, because they don't really impact things in a major way. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. This is the first time that, well, I don't know if it's the first time, because I believe that Lost was the biggest show ever on television when it was at its height.
Oh, yeah.
Game of Thrones is, again, the biggest show that's ever been on television in terms of viewership, in terms of, like, budget. And it went this route. But it's definitely up there in terms of divisiveness, if not out-and-out quality.
Are you trying to build a theory where by large, enormously loved television shows simply can't finish in a non-divisive, satisfying way?
I think it's hard. It's because it's always like everyone has, like, what I've observed in my almost decade of doing this is a lot of the fun and people's enjoyment is making predictions and then seeing those things either come true or seeing how they misread the hints and something even better happened. People don't like it when something predictable happens, and people don't like it when something just completely out of left field happens. And when you've got a show that's been going on X amount of years with 50, 60, 70 hours of footage available, and people have been speculating it for 7 years, every season that goes on makes that something fresh and different, but familiar and relatable, that barrier gets harder and harder and harder. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think a lot of these things that do seem to, like, you know, like the Lost and Mad Men just pivot to, like, you know, fuck it, we're just going to go for something that feels emotionally right or feel like this feels like a similar to the tone of the entire show, then it actually feels like a really neat bow that we're putting on it.
Yeah, I think the best thing you can do is write a strongly character focused drama. If drama is your thing, focus on the characters, because I think you can do predictable. You can also do satisfying if you're focused on the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that I think Breaking Bad does so well, is, yeah, there are twists and turns along the way of the plot, but I never really felt like I was super in the dark on those, right? Mm-hmm. And the occasional time where it does twist up, it's like, okay, everything makes sense. But in the end, it's all about the characters. And if I'm feeling good about the characters in the finale, then you've done your job with that show.
Mm-hmm.
It's they're not trying to, let's twist it up one final time, you know? Let's really nail this final one. No, just focus on the characters and the drama will be satisfying.
Yeah, and I think that I don't know what Game of Thrones' legacy will be in the final estimation, because I think that there's a broad consensus that if you stop at the end of season 6, then this is just an amazing setup for an endgame. And then I think that consensus does feel like the endgame is a little feels curiously rushed and botched and not as thought through. So what do you do with that? Like, I don't know. Like, if the books are finished and like George Martin comes up with a satisfying conclusion that kind of matches up at the end of season 6, and I think there's going to be still a lot of people loving Game of Thrones, because one thing I'll forever be grateful for Game of Thrones is that it was so well cast that when I went to read the books, it was much easier to get in those books, because I had I knew what Ned looked like. I knew what his sons and daughters looked like. I knew what Cersei Lannister looked like. I knew what, the Robert Baratheon looked like. And that's I think that's super helpful. It'll be neat to have all of these visualizations. Maybe my imagination's just broke because I'm too old. But I think it'll be cool when I read Winds of Winter and Dream of Spring, assuming they come out, is I'll already have like all this stuff, these set pieces in mind. And all George has to do is have a more satisfying way. And then suddenly season 7 and 8 is redeemable, because like the Battle of King's Landing is pretty cool. The Battle of Winterfell is pretty cool. There's some individual beats and military tactics that don't make sense, but like what's on the screen is fucking amazing. So like having that as like your Cliff Notes version, or your, as kind of just like something running in your head while you're reading that, I think is going to be valuable and useful. And also if the prequels can shade in some of the Night King's motivations and make, just single-handedly make that part of the plot more meaningful, so the Battle of Winterfell feels more significant, because it really does. That's the other thing I think season 8 did, is that it did make all of the White Walker shit that we assumed was so important kind of irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Like it had all that build up and it was dealt with in a single episode. And I don't know how you fix that. And we probably will be debating this for weeks, months, years to come.
Oh yeah. So I see, the debate already happening online. And it's cooling off a little bit. And I think everybody is so oversaturated with Game of Thrones at this point. Every single person that I hear talk about the show is like, oh man, that ending, either I loved it or I hated it and here's why, but also, I'm glad it's over. Like I'm just tired of it. Like, I love the show, but I'm tired,
Or Emilia Clarke, we're tired of getting up at 3:30 in the morning and having her hair done.
Right. And maybe that's the bittersweet that George is talking about. It's simply like, the show that you love is going away, but also everything, all the baggage, like all the constant bombardment, because it's everywhere. You can't escape Game of Thrones. And if you're online, you know what Game of Thrones is. You've heard about Game of Thrones, and the people who are in it and have been in it for years, I think, are ready for a break.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's a sentiment I see. But like the thing about the show that I think will be remembered is the journey, because it's always about the journey more so than the destination. And the journey, for the most part, was excellent on this show. If you look at seasons 1 through 4, I can't think of a bad scene in the entirety of them. Even seasons 5, 6, and 7, there was a lot of good mixed in with, some minor bad stuff.
Yeah.
And then season 8, I think fell off a cliff, but a lot of people don't. But ultimately, like, everybody had fun. And this was the thing that I love about Lost, is you just had fun talking about it with everybody, going on this journey, seeing what would happen next week, speculating on, where is this going to go? What could this mean? So many people did that. And, for us as podcasters also, it was a journey with our fans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, I'm glad that everybody joined us on this, and you know, the journey isn't over necessarily, because we will be covering the prequels, or whatever, if it's just a prequel, mm-hmm. or multiple prequels, we'll be covering them. But yeah, I just really appreciate, you know, everything that we as a community have done around Game of Thrones. But let's just take a breath and wait for these new shows to come.
Yeah.
Wait for the books to come. You know, let's maybe not have this argument right now, because it's too emotionally charged. I think people are getting very defensive on both sides mm-hmm. about their opinion of it, me included. And if we give it a few years, you know, give it until the prequels are upon us, then we can start talking about this and looking back at it and saying, okay, how do we really feel about this? What's the good and what's the bad? Because right now it's either the worst thing or the best thing mm-hmm. ever. And that's not accurate. Neither of those opinions are accurate.
Yeah, and I'll always remember, especially stuff from season one, which I hadn't read the books, like when Jaime threw Bran out the window, when you know, Tyrion's trial by combat, Ned being beheaded, like
at the Red Wedding. I mean, yeah, there's
yeah, like and because I already knew the Red, but like when I read the Red Wedding and the Purple Wedding and the death of Oberon at the hands of the Mountain, and seeing all those things happen. It was just so incredibly rewarding, like the things that happened exactly the way I thought it would happen, and things that happened slightly different, but because they were smart adaptations, like, I'll always remember that.
Yeah.
So I just think that they had some trouble sticking the landing. George will get his shot if he wants to take it. I do think that in my lifetime, this will almost certainly be remade. Like, I'm trying to think, like, does it get remade especially if George Wright finishes the books, or especially if, because I almost feel like it's more, if he finishes and it's awesome, then it's definitely going to get remade. If he finishes and it sucks, then, like, it might kill it for good. But if he never finishes, then, like, I almost feel like that's such a challenge to filmmakers everywhere. Like, this is unfilmable. Like,
right.
We thought it was unfilmable. We got six seasons into it. Turns out no one can finish this thing. It's unfilmable. Like, that's like a gauntlet thrown for every aspiring filmmaker
sure.
that has any kind of soft spot for science fiction fantasy. A lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you not, 20, 30 years in the future, how do you not, you know, pick that gauntlet up and be like, you know, shit, we're just going to tweak these things, and we're going to come up with a new cast, and we're going to do it.
Yeah, so. I think it'll be done.
That's it for Game of Thrones. Of course, it's not it for Bald Move. We've talked about the Bald Move TV podcast, that we've got Chernobyl going, that we're going to be getting Stranger Things going, that we've got Watchmen coming out later this year, and tons more of stuff like that. The finale of Mr. Robot, this Dark Materials looks really interesting. We're going to be taking a close look at that, too. Lots of stuff if you want to continue your journey with Bald Move. Even on the Game of Thrones universe, we'll be keeping this feed around and talking about the prequels. You can follow us on our social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at Bald Move. We really hope you stick around. We've enjoyed having you. And we will hope to see you in the wars to come. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Signing off. Goodbye.